Hi and welcome to Module 3. Now, in this module, we're going to be covering an area that I would loosely call United Nations Documents and NGO Diplomacy. Now, a little bit more specifically, what we're going to be looking at in this Module 3 are resolutions, treaties, landmark documents, and international days, years, and decades. We're going to be looking at during the next lesson at a focus on the Millennium Declaration and the MDGs, because that's a very potent and very top of the list issue area for the United Nations at this stage as we're coming up to the year 2015. Now, we'll also then go on into resolutions, their secret language, and how to use the UN document library. That'll be just a little bit of a more narrow focus on resolutions and UN documents. Then we'll get into how to lobby intergovernmental meetings, and we'll have two parts to that component later on this week. So we've actually got a huge amount of area to cover, even in this third module. And of course, we have much, much more to come. So let's get back to lesson 11. And so we're going to look very briefly, because, you know, of course, the in-depth amount of work that goes on in all of these areas is what consumes so much of the United Nations time. Now, resolutions are the main means by which the United Nations accomplishes its work. In that mix, there are also recommendations, statements, and then we get to the international level of treaties and conventions and the like. Now, then we can look at what are called landmark documents, some of which are maybe treaties or conventions, that, for example, the Charter itself. And then we'll also look at international days, years, and decades, which are markers and more public relations efforts of the United Nations to bring attention to certain topics and issues and to give people a way to gather around those topics and address them collectively as civil society, nations, and more. So back to what we would consider the landmark, and these are all General Assembly documents. Now there's a little bit that I want to slip in after this that deals with the Security Council in particular, and just a little sliver of a glimpse of how the Security Council is using its resolutions to further the work and the functioning of the United Nations and actually changing the shape and scope of its work. But back to these few landmark General Assembly documents, and they include the United Nations Charter from 1945, and just a few years later, and one that I'm sure most of you will have heard about, which is the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and that was signed in 1948 here in New York. Then in 1950, and I've referred to this document already, Uniting for Peace, which was passed, Resolution 377, which was passed in 1950. Then another one that the United Nations recognizes as a landmark document was the 1979 Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women. Now, I've added in the 2000 Millennium Declaration, which was 55 years later, the reaffirmation of the United Nations as the world was changing from the 1900s to the new 2000s, and there was a very strong focus and heightened sense of awareness, as happens for everybody, as we turn a new year or a new century, and indeed a new millennium. There was a heightened focus on the United Nations, and at that time, there were a lot of discussions around that era that started at that time and continued through until 2005, when the United Nations was celebrating its 60th anniversary in 2005, when again there was this sense of looking again at the United Nations, looking at the issue of renewal, what that would mean. There were special high-level commissions that were tasked with looking at this issue from a number of different perspectives. Some comprehensive reports came out, and there were a lot of discussions and debates that were going on at the time. And in fact, while they died down at that time without any clear resolution, There have nevertheless continued some levels of discussions of United Nations renewal, although in the discussions, the scope of renewal of the United Nations that was being talked about in 2005 has narrowed down to the focus on issues surrounding the Security Council. That's just a little bit of background there. Now, back to treaties. Now, resolutions, the main difference, I think I may have mentioned this, but the main difference between resolutions and treaties. Now, resolutions within the General Assembly merely remain recommendations to the nations. They are not binding on the nations. Any resolution that comes out of the General Assembly is a recommendation that a nation can choose to take up. A treaty, however, goes through a different process, and once it is signed by a nation, that means that that nation is agreeing legally through international law to be bound by the terms and the conditions of that treaty. You will notice, however, that every member of the United Nations does not necessarily sign all of the treaties that come out of the United Nations. And so there's a whole treaty process that takes place. Why a nation hasn't signed a particular treaty at a particular time, maybe just an issue of timing. Each member state, each country has to take that treaty back to their country, back to their government. Their government has to debate the issues, decide whether or not their country is prepared to sign on to that treaty and be bound to that treaty. Then they have to come back and sign and become party to that treaty. So in fact, there's a lot of machinery involved, a lot of different levels of agreement, debate, and procedures that take place at the international and intergovernmental level. And then, of course, it has to go back to the nations and the governments. And depending, some governments are in internal turmoil, and they cannot get to even having discussions about that. Some of the countries, it is a politically unsavory treaty, and so therefore are unwilling at the national level, at the country level, to approve the signing of the treaty, and so that treaty for that country remains unsigned. One of the more notable ones is the Kyoto Protocol, which is an international environmental treaty, first drafted in 1997. But today, 191 countries have signed and ratified a modified version of the treaty, but the United States and Australia are still two of the developed countries that have not signed this treaty, and clearly it is for political reasons, and they differ on certain aspects of the treaty, whether it be the science or the negotiated agreements or whatever it might be, but they have not signed this particular treaty. There are many other treaties that many other nations, for whatever internal reasons or internal politics they may have not become party to those treaties. What I have here is just, and we'll go on into the treaty collection just very briefly, but it's just to show that even at the United Nations, UNITAR, which is the UN Institute of Training and Research, it has to provide training for both the permanent representatives and the other diplomats within the United Nations, even for them to fully understand the real nitty-gritty details of the whole treaty process on the international side. So in this you can see that the diplomatic community and the member states are responsible for doing the work of negotiating the treaties, signing them, etc. But the United Nations Secretariat also has to provide the infrastructure and the framework, understanding and knowledge base that is required to enable this process to continue over time. So here we are at the United Nations Treaty Collection, and as you can see, they indicate that every treaty and every international agreement entered into by any member of the United Nations after the present charter comes into force shall as soon as possible be registered by the Secretariat and published by it. And that's Article 102 of the Charter of the United Nations. So there is the expectation that, in fact, every member state will become party to the treaty. However, as we just went over, you can see that it doesn't always happen quite so simply and easily. And over the years, there are a number of treaties and agreements that nations have entered into. And again, they are distinct from the resolutions of the General Assembly. So here, if you go to this website at httptreaties.un.org, you can find most of the treaty collection. Here, you can go in and get an overview. From here, you can get information on the status of over 500 major multilateral instruments that have been deposited with the Secretary General of the United Nations as of now. And it covers, a wide range of subjects, such as human rights, disarmament, environment, refugees, law of the sea, commodities, and so on. So there are databases, and you can go to this page and look at all the different kinds of databases that there are, including, for example, texts of the treaties that have been deposited with the Secretary General, and the Secretary General is the official receiver of the treaties and agreements. You can see the status of them. You can get copies. You can see those that are still open for signature. You can usually get some kind of update on nations that have signed, ratified, acceded, or lodged declarations, reservations, or objections to any of the treaties. In the publications area, they just bring to you the relevant part of the UN Charter. And here, this is where they indicate the kinds of training that are available for diplomats, members of the diplomatic community, about treaties in particular. Now, one of the ways that the United Nations brings full attention to treaty is through treaty events. Now, for example, if a treaty has to do with drugs and crime, often the UN Office of Drugs and Crime will have a special event at UN headquarters and back in Vienna. They'll have speakers, they'll try to bring public attention to bear, they'll do whatever they can to bring attention to the treaty and to the importance of the treaty, the scope of, and the hope and the aspirations of what it will do, and all of those kinds of details. They try to involve the press, of course, because they recognize and acknowledge the importance of public attention to all of these areas and the importance of public attention to those countries that are or are not signing the treaties, and in fact, not just whether they are or whether they aren't, but why they may be or may not be. Sometimes that adds to the dialogue and the discussion. Sometimes it's one of the ways of endeavoring to get countries to live up to their previous commitments and promises and that kind of effort. So that just gives you a little bit of a look and hopefully just broadens your understanding about treaties and international agreements that become legally binding to all of the countries that are part of the United Nations. So let's continue on. As I mentioned, I wanted to talk a little bit about the Security Council and how the resolutions have been a means to expand its functions, authority, and jurisdiction. But this, in fact, has only happened since the end of the Cold War. And Michael Matheson, in his book Council Unbound, brought this out, as he noted that the Security Council has developed since that time an entirely new system of legal authority for managing threats to peace and security. So we're going to take just a couple of minutes to look at how and why. The how is through the resolutions and utilizing and drawing upon certain elements of the Charter, and how the Charter, in fact, is not meant to be a static document, but is a living document which allows the evolution and growth of the organization through the use of the Charter, and the needs, the global needs that surround these shifts and changes, and of course, some of the concerns that come along with this. But anyway, so just for a moment, we're going to go a little bit into the developments in the Security Council since pretty much the end of the Cold War, 1992, roughly. Once the stonewalling had stopped amongst the permanent five of the Security Council, then a number of things could begin to change. Michael Matheson also wanted to make a very simple point, is that noting that prior to the UN Charter, there were in fact no limits of any kind on the use of force by nations. And by signing into the United Nations Charter, governments volunteered to step into a more controlled and limited set of relationships with one another, and limits on their, what they considered to be their sovereign right prior to that time, their sovereign right to utilize force where they felt was needed. And of course, there's all debate, all kinds of debates about the morality of that, and all, but just sticking with the specifics at this stage. Now, since the Cold War, the Security Council has significantly activated and broadened its authority and jurisdiction, and it's primarily through Article 39's mandate, which is to quote-unquote maintain or restore international peace and security. Now, why is that important? If you remember back, the situation in Rwanda really brought to the fore, the issues of the United Nations. At that time, the United Nations, going by the letter of the law as it was written in the UN Charter, had no right to interfere in the sovereign activities of Rwanda. The United Nations could step in to conflicts between nations, but they had no right to step into the sovereign issues, into those issues which were considered domestic, as the law and resolutions were written at the time of the UN Charter. And therefore, that was why, even though there were UN peacekeeping forces in Rwanda at the time of the genocide, they were instructed clearly not to fire or on anyone or do anything other than to observe and to protect, of course, UN personnel. Now, this set up a huge dilemma globally. And so that's where people went back to the UN Charter, looked at it again, read it again, and knew that they could not allow this kind of thing to happen. The very charter that was meant to prevent conflict and protect people from violence and violation, in this particular case, had effectively mandated people to stand by and watch grave violations. And this was clearly unacceptable. So what the Security Council did is they read into Chapter 7 that there are times appropriate if internal situations were determined by the Security Council to be, and the piece they picked up on was a threat to the peace. So given that their mandate is to deal with threats to the peace, what they did was to broaden their authority to step into grave situations taking place within nations if it is deemed by the Security Council to be a threat to the peace in the region. So even though it was not one nation threatening another nation overtly through war, the nature of what was going on within that country was effectively threatening the peace in other surrounding countries. And that may have been due to severe humanitarian crises, ethnic conflicts, or large flows of refugees across border, significant human rights violations, and threats to democracy that also threatened to destabilize the region. So bottom line, what the Security Council was doing was expanding their reading of their authority to step in and address threats to the peace. And because of the resolutions that took place as a consequence of this new reading of the security of the charter after the Rwanda genocide, you could begin to see the scope of the authority and the work of the Security Council expanded. Now, also, because there have been generic worldwide threats such as terrorism, proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, dealing with issues of non-state entities that are a threat to peace, such as transnational criminal activity, and are based, of course, within different nations around the world, the Security Council now has a new means to address these through the expanded conception and authorization of the Security Council. Also, what we've seen happen and take place since the end of the Cold War is that there have been what they call third generation peacekeeping. And that's where, for example, in Kosovo and in East Timor, where UN designated forces assumed virtually all the functions of the governing territories. They kind of became virtual forces, police forces, and anyway, ground troops for that country during the interim period in the immediate post-conflict situation. These types of situations had not taken place before. They are new developments, which again is shifting the nature of how the UN sees its role, how the Security Council sees its role, and how there needs to be different funding, different interactions between nations. It opens up whole new areas of problems, challenges to all of these changes. Questions become, how long does the UN peacekeepers have this kind of authority to stay in these nations? Should they drag on? You know, if they pull out at a certain stage, is that going to further destabilize? What does the United Nations do then? How do the P5 decide on those circumstances? I think you can begin to see that there are many, many complex issues that come as a consequence. Also, since that time, there have become new technical commissions that largely have to be effective, again, in post-conflict environments, and they're often involved in the rebuilding of war-torn territories in an effort to hasten their reintegration into the world community. So these are some of the developments that have taken place. And as this has happened, of course, there's been new tensions that have emerged between the existing instruments and frameworks and those that need to be newly put in place to deal with the current developments. It does create new challenges, need for new discussions, meetings, funding, new knowledge and experience and access to resources, experts, and the like. And of course, from the perspective of NGOs, a lot of this area of work, all of the experts are not within the UN system itself. They cannot fund them. They do not necessarily know. And so again, that kind of reaffirms the need for the expert side that to come into many of these areas, whether it be dealing with post-conflict, the peace-building efforts that need to take place, building up police forces. That is work that is done not by the government per se, at least not in democratic nations, in developing functioning economic systems and how to get those up and running, in making sure that there are good media systems in place in these post-conflict situations. All of this kind of work that requires expert knowledge that is not the expert field of governments is an area that NGOs bring. So that's just a quick glimpse at some of the inner evolution that has been going on in the United Nations. It gives us a bit of an idea of the kinds of work and concerns and challenges that are faced at the international level. Oh, there's so much stuff in there, and a lot of it is fascinating and interesting, and a lot of it is challenging to all of us, and not just the Security Council members. You can see how there are urgently needed NGOs and NGOs with their specific areas of expertise to bolster and augment and step in to do much of the work that governments, quite frankly, cannot. And being able to see this from the global perspective is very valuable for as many people to see. And this kind of links us then with the next component, which are the international days, years, and decades. These are ways that the United Nations uses and that we can be involved in to bring attention to key issues that are either relevant, highly relevant to our organizations, and to pull in and draw in others to either be aware of our perspectives, what we consider our particular unique NGOs take on each of these different areas, plus pay attention to the work that is being done by other NGOs, by the United Nations itself, and in fact to just heighten awareness and knowledge about the areas that of work to help make our world a better, more peaceful, more equitable, and wonderful place to live. So these are ways that the United Nations brings attention to and enables member states and NGOs to rally around the issues, declarations, and significant concerns. Why don't we go on over to the website and take a quick look at this page. So here we are at the meetings, conferences, meetings, and events page. And right here, it just has most of the more relevant ones, current meetings, those that are coming up. You can get to the past conferences, meetings, and events from here. I haven't gone over the UN Journal, but this is always an important area for those of you who are following current issues or know that you're going to be in the United Nations on a particular date and want to know what's going on that date, what you can get into, what meetings are open, what are informal discussions, what are formal discussions, closed and open meetings, etc. You can find press releases and daily news, daily briefings, and webcasts. Again, these are areas that we will look at later on. But for the moment, what we want to do is go down here and look at the observances. As you can see, there are international days, there are international weeks, there are international years, and in effect, there are international decades. And this is during the last quarter of the 1900s, there were actually a lot of international conferences and a lot of diplomacy was conducted in these settings. But that way of conducting international business has slowed down. A lot of the issues were dealt with at that international level. A lot of work was done by those international conferences, and now the focus is on implementation. And that's part of what we will get into tomorrow as we begin to look at the Millennium Declaration and the MDGs as we look at that in detail. But I just wanted to bring your attention to these international days, weeks, years, and decades. So I would strongly recommend that you come in here and according to your NGO's interest, focus, and expertise, and get ideas. Now, there's almost some kind of something going on every month. So what that does, you can have your monthly meetings centered around some of these topics. You can use it to educate yourself, use it to educate others, use it to educate youth. You can use it to promote one of the international days at your community level or state level as one of the ways to allow you to go out and pull together many other, either NGOs or parts of your government, local government, and to use it to build your social capital. But this is one excellent way to do a couple of things, and that's to further your own members' understanding of the issues that your NGO is dealing with, to be able to present your own NGO's unique contribution to a particular topic, to use a particular day or date as a way to get local media attention and or build social capital and work with other NGOs or government departments or local government in areas that you may have a desire to affect change within. So as you can see, you go through all of the months, May, June, July. There are some months that are way more active than others, whether you're dealing with issues about older people, you want to deal with nonviolence, you want to deal with housing, you want to deal with education, you want to deal with mental health or with language, women, not just, well, there's women's, here you've got International Day of Rural Women, rural women have a unique challenge in front of them, and that's still different, but connected to International Women's Day, which is back here in March, March 8th. I would encourage you to look through all of these days. You can see that there are many opportunities. We can go back and we can look at international weeks. There is not as many of these, but they have weeks where they focus on specific issues. World Space Week, World Breastfeeding Week, Global Action Week on Education that's headed up by UNICEF and others. And then you've got the international years and international decades. I just want to bring your attention to one particular one that is wrapping up, the International Year for the Rapprochement of the Cultures. It comes out of Resolution 6290. And if you track back that history of where Resolution 6290 was driven from, and I'll go into some of the issues of resolutions and how they set a series of activities into motion. But if you were to trace this resolution backwards, you will find that this can be traced right back to a 2004 resolution that was passed in the General Assembly on the 11th of November in 2004, A/59/23. That particular resolution would not have come into being if I had not been involved in mobilizing, working with a group of member states that were interested, that were willing, and I could go, this is a whole discussion, but were willing to step out and talk about a topic that was pretty much taboo in those times. And we started these discussions. I started these discussions with some of them back in 2001. And then it came to the stage where there was a draft resolution presented in 2003, and it was finally passed in 2004. And that resolution then became, it was a toe in the door that opened up then a series of resolutions that has resulted in this International Year for the Rapprochement of Cultures. And again, to explain the value and the significance of that, I don't have time right now. I think I've gone well over my short time for a lesson this week. But perhaps at some stage, I can tell that story virtually as a case study of how to work with member states to get resolutions passed. Some of these issues actually will come out later on this week, perhaps in the context of dealing with the lobbying intergovernmental meetings. But that's a little bit different than what happened here. This was a little bit more of a quiet approach because the topic actually was such a sensitive one, it had to be dealt with very carefully at the time. And you can't see that from this face value. But again, I guess I'm kind of partial to that topic because I was so involved and spearheaded the initial stages of that, of course, as an NGO. We cannot pass resolutions in the General Assembly, but we can do a lot of the groundwork, plant the seeds, plant the ideas, get the people together, hand them over the resources that governments actually need to be able to move forward, to feel that it is something that can be done, and to then embolden them to go forward, and with especially in areas that are more sensitive than others. The United Nations being the preeminently political environment that it is not always easy to make things move forward substantively. Tiny little thing in the bigger picture, but nevertheless, I'm very proud to say that if I and my team had not worked at the United Nations when we did, this would not be there today. Let me go back to our homework really quickly. Your homework, I want you to reread again, in the light of today's challenges of terrorism, transnational crime, human trafficking, and the like, the UN Charter section on the Security Council. I want you to find it, I want you to look for it, and then I want you to read a couple of the different sections. And whether you think that it is adequate as it was written to cope with today's threats, challenges, and the changes that are going on. And then, in the light of what I went over in this lesson on the Security Council issues. Then also I want you to reflect on, and you don't have to become an expert in this at the moment, but I just want you to engage in thinking about, what do you think the UN needs to augment its current systems that will enable it to fulfill its mandate to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war? And with that, do take a few minutes to think about this. Discuss with a friend, discuss with a colleague, bring the topic up. There is no right and wrong answer to this. Part of my point in dealing with the United Nations and all of this is that the problems are growing and changing. There is no magical answer out there. But we can choose to be part of the solution by dealing with the issues at hand in constructive and proactive ways, set agendas, develop approaches, clarify principles, offer frameworks and mindsets, a solution to what many see as enormous and threatening problems. With that, finally, I close today's lesson and look forward to seeing you again tomorrow.